Welcome to HN Pod, your daily dive into the top stories and discussions from Hacker News. I am Sarah.
And I am Mike. Today is Saturday, July 4th, 2026, which means we are unpacking the biggest stories that hit the front page yesterday, July 3rd. Welcome to episode 446.
We have a really fascinating lineup today. We are going to talk about a hilarious but all too real startup parable about baking ovens, the ongoing war over Apple CarPlay and modern vehicles, some cool open source hardware from Valve, why American internet speeds are lagging behind Switzerland, and finally, a very serious data privacy emergency brewing in the US government.
Let us kick things off with that startup parable. It was a blog post by an author named Welly, titled Half-Baked Product, and it rocked up over 1,200 points. It's written as a fictional story, but it hits incredibly close to home for anyone who has ever worked in tech.
It really does. The story follows a founder who decides to disrupt the industrial oven market, not because he knows anything about baking, but because he did some market analysis on a spreadsheet and realized if he captures just 10% of the Spanish market, he will be a billionaire. So he hires a brilliant, passionate engineer who actually loves ovens and spends all his free time arguing on Italian oven forums.
I love that detail. The Italian oven forums are the ultimate source of truth for this guy. So they built a minimum viable product. It has an algorithm that supposedly detects when bread or pizza is perfectly baked. The problem is, it only works a third of the time. The rest of the time, it burns the food or leaves it raw. But they sell 5 prototypes to friends and family, and the founder uses those 5 sales to raise $5 million from venture capitalists.
And this is where the classic startup trap springs. The founder hires a massive sales team of people who know nothing about ovens, but are, as the story puts it, hungry to sell. They realize small bakeries will not buy a buggy oven because if it fails, they go out of business. So the founder pivots to enterprise sales and lands a massive deal with a corporate pizza chain called Pepe Pizza.
But Pepe Pizza requires custom dimensions and a rotating base, which completely breaks the thermal design and the algorithm the engineer spent months building. The founder doesn't care. He just says, make it happen. The engineer has to hack together a compromised, half-broken prototype in 3 weeks just to keep the deal alive.
The Hacker News comments on this were gold. One commenter named TrackerFF pointed out that this perfectly describes the mismatch between a founder driven purely by market analysis and wealth versus a domain expert who actually knows what is possible. They mentioned sitting through pitches where the founder has zero domain expertise, but off the charts enthusiasm. Another commenter replied that they recently met a startup founder who was, quote, pretty fluent in consultant.
Fluent and consultant is such a great phrase. I am definitely stealing that. The comments also went down a really interesting rabbit hole about founder motivations. Someone brought up Elon Musk as the classic example of naive optimism moving the needle, which sparked a massive debate. People were arguing over whether tech billionaires are driven by money, a desire to go to Mars, or just pure narcissism and a need for approval, citing his recent antics playing video games like Path of Exile to get media attention.
It is a tale as old as time in Silicon Valley, the visionary who promises the moon and the engineer who has to actually build the rocket out of duct tape. But let us pivot from startup ovens to electric vehicles. Our next story is a fiery blog post from Casey Liss titled CarPlay is Additive.
Casey is a well-known iOS developer and podcaster, and he was writing in response to a recent interview with Rivian's chief software officer, Wassim Ben Said. Basically, Rivian refuses to support Apple CarPlay in their vehicles, and in this interview, Wassim defended the decision by saying that screen mirroring solutions take over every single pixel in the car, and that is not how Rivian wants to interact with its users.
Casey absolutely went off on this. He pointed out that this is just factually untrue. CarPlay does not have to take up the entire screen. He even posted a photo of CarPlay running in a Volvo, where the Volvo user interface is clearly visible above and below the CarPlay window. His main argument is that CarPlay is additive. It is optional. If Rivian's native software is really as good as they claim, users will just choose to use that. But blocking CarPlay entirely just alienates buyers. Casey said he literally will not buy a car without it, and he canceled his plans to buy a Rivian R2 because of this.
The Hacker News community had a lot to say about the economics of this. A user named Lin Zhang Run pointed out the real advantage of CarPlay, which is that it stays up to date. The computing platform is your phone. The car is just a dumb terminal. If you buy a car today, you might keep it for 10 or 15 years. The built-in infotainment system is going to feel like a dinosaur in 5 years, but CarPlay will always run the latest iOS.
Exactly. Another commenter mentioned they just bought a 10-year-old Toyota station wagon and swapped in a new head unit with wireless Android Auto, and suddenly it feels like a modern car. But the automakers hate this. They want to own the ecosystem. There was a whole subthread about how car manufacturers are seemingly making cars harder to repair and tying parts to proprietary software to shorten the lifespan of vehicles. They want you treating your $60,000 car like a smartphone that you upgrade every 3 years.
Which is financially impossible for most people. It is a fascinating battle for the dashboard. Automakers think they are software companies now, but users just want their Spotify and Overcast apps to work without learning a new clunky interface.
Speaking of companies and their hardware ecosystems, our next story is a breath of fresh air. The title is Valve Open Source the Steam Machine E-Ink Screen So You Can Make Your Own, from the site Gaming on Linux.
Valve has been doing some really interesting stuff with their hardware lately. With the new Steam Machine, they originally teased this cool little e-ink display on the front of the case. But instead of manufacturing and selling it themselves as an expensive add-on, they just uploaded all the CAD files, the STL files, and the code to their GitLab under an MIT essence. They are calling it the Ink Interface.
It is so cool. They even provided a full parts list. You just need an Adafruit ESP32 board, a specific 5.8-inch monochrome e-ink panel, and some magnets and screws. You can literally 3D print the housing and build it yourself.
The Hacker News thread got incredibly nerdy about e-ink technology, which I loved. Someone asked about the refresh rate of these panels, and a former firmware engineer who worked on the Remarkable tablets chimed in. They explained that e-ink pixels are actually vertical columns of viscous fluid with charged ink particles.
Right, and they use these proprietary electrical waveforms to shift the particles up and down. More black particles at the top means a darker shade of gray. But if you push the refresh rate too high, the fluid gets messy and you get ghosting. So you have to occasionally do a hard rail-to-rail voltage reset to clear the screen, which is that full-screen flash you see on Kindles.
It is amazing how much secret sauce goes into just making a screen flip pages smoothly. People were speculating about how to reverse engineer those secret waveforms, but mostly the thread was just full of praise for Valve. In an era where companies like Rivian are locking down their ecosystems and Apple is fighting right to repair,
the premise here is that in Switzerland, you can get a dedicated, symmetrical 25 gigabit fiber connection to your house for a very reasonable price. Meanwhile, in the US and Germany, people are stuck with much slower, shared connections, often from a single monopoly provider. Chiffon argues this comes down to how these countries view the internet. He says fiber is a natural monopoly, just like water pipes.
Right, it makes zero sense to have three different water companies digging up your street to lay three different pipes. The Swiss model treats the physical fiber in the ground as a neutral, shared public asset. Every home gets four dedicated fiber strands. Those strands go to a neutral hub, and then any internet service provider can connect to you. You just call an ISP, give them the ID number on your wall plate, and they turn you on. Total competition on the service layer, but a monopoly on the physical layer.
Compare that to the US, where we have territorial monopolies. Comcast gets one neighborhood, AT&T gets another. They do not compete, they just extract rent. And because they use a shared architecture, your 1 gigabit connection slows to a crawl when your whole neighborhood logs onto Netflix at 8 p.m.
Stefan also calls out Germany, which tried a pure free market approach and ended up with companies overbuilding. They literally dig up the same street twice to lay parallel cables, wasting billions of euros that could have been spent connecting rural areas.
The comments on this one were a fierce debate. A lot of people immediately jumped in to say, well, Switzerland is tiny and the US is massive, so of course it is harder to wire America. But others pushed back hard on that. A user named Triskarama pointed out that physical size does not matter as much as population density. Yes, the US has huge empty spaces like Wyoming, but the people living in dense suburbs in California or Texas are still getting ripped off compared to people in Zurich.
There was also a funny side debate about whether anyone actually needs 25 gigabit internet. Most people agreed it is totally overkill and mostly a marketing gimmick, but the underlying point remains. The Swiss infrastructure allows for that kind of bandwidth easily because it is point-to-point active Ethernet, not the cheap shared passive optical networks we use in the States.
It is a policy choice, not a technology limitation. Speaking of policy choices, our final story today is a very serious one. It is a guest post on Scott Aronson's blog by Cynthia Dwork and several other prominent computer scientists, titled An American Privacy Emergency.
For context, Cynthia Dwork is a pioneer in the field of differential privacy. The Post is raising the alarm about a directive issued on June 4th by the U.S. Secretary of Commerce.
The directive, known as Dow 21626, essentially bans the Bureau of Economic Analysis and the U.S. Census Bureau from using modern privacy protection techniques, specifically banning something called noise infusion.
To explain why this matters, we have to talk about how the census works. By law, the Census Bureau has to publish demographic data, but it is also legally required to protect the confidentiality of individuals. In the past, they would just round numbers or suppress small data points. But with modern computing, if you release enough granular data, bad actors can cross-reference it with other databases and re-identify specific individuals.
To stop that, scientists invented differential privacy and noise infusion. Basically, they inject a mathematically calculated amount of random noise into the dataset. It keeps the big picture statistics accurate for researchers, but makes it mathematically impossible to unmask any specific person. The Census Bureau used this in 2020 and planned to use it in 2030.
But this new directive bans it entirely, forcing the government to go back to privacy techniques from the 1970s. The authors of the blog post argued this is not about science, it is entirely political. They point out that this fulfills a promise made by the architects of Project 2025.
The Hacker News comments dug deep into the motives here. A user named Another linked to explanations showing that political operatives hate differential privacy because it stops them from reconstructing records for highly targeted gerrymandering. The conservative groups pushing this directive have explicitly complained that differential privacy makes it impossible to ascertain the citizenship status of individuals in the census data.
It is incredibly chilling. If the census cannot guarantee privacy, people will simply stop answering the surveys, especially vulnerable populations. And if the data is compromised, it breaks the foundation of how we allocate representation and funding in the U.S. The comments were quite dark, with many users noting that the erosion of privacy has been a bipartisan slide for decades, from the Patriot Act to PRISM, but this feels like a very targeted acceleration to enable domestic surveillance.
It is definitely a story that the tech and academic communities are watching closely, and it is going to have massive ripple effects on data science and econometrics in the coming years.
Well, on that somewhat heavy note, that brings us to the end of today's episode.
Thanks for joining us as we unpacked the best of Hacker News. We will be back tomorrow with more top stories, startup drama, and tech deep dives.
Have a great weekend, everyone. See you tomorrow.